Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, and we're happy to have a good friend with us, a dear Dominican, Father Gregory Pine, who is making waves with his new book called Training the Tongue and Growing Beyond Sins of Speech. It's a perfect read this Lenten season, and we are particularly happy to have him on as we approach Holy Week. Welcome to the show, Father.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You speak with so much candor, Father, about your own sins of speech in this book. Can you tell us what prompted you to write it and how hard or easy it was to reveal your faults and failings?
So I think what prompted me to write it is just an experience of frustration in the sense that, you know, we're conscious of the fact that we often fall afoul of the law of the Lord and that we often slip into sins of speech. And a kind of initial experience of frustration might give rise to a vow or a hastily formulated promise to not speak nearly as much or not speak quite as much in the future. So conscious of the fact that we have failed, we might relegate ourselves to silence. But as it turns out, the goal of the Christian life isn't so much sinlessness as it is graciousness, you know? And so I thought that just to kind of tap into those experiences that folks have and then propose the life of grace and virtue and gifts of the Holy Spirit as a way forward, which is to say, like, the Lord wants to consecrate our speech, or he wants to redeem our speech, not just relegate us to silence. So I think it's just, yeah, helping people to tap into that as a way by which to motivate our ongoing conversion.
And it seems like the first person who you had a lot of these encounters with naturally would be your mother, who didn't hesitate to do fraternal correction.
That's right.
Or stop you from saying words that you shouldn't say.
That's right. Yeah, my mom had a kind of business-like approach to these things. She was born in New York, and she grew up, I mean, her family was in Staten Island, and then she herself grew up in North Jersey. So I think candor came readily to her in a way that made our family home a kind of delightful setting for all manner of Christian conversation. And I think too, you know, like culturally speaking, I'm from that same region. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. And that's not to say that courtesy or a certain cultural politesse is not a good thing, depending upon the time, place, and circumstances. But I think, yeah, to be from Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey is to have privileged access to...
Which apparently didn't go very well in Kentucky, right?
Yeah, not necessarily, no. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you begin with St. James, and I love some of the quotes that you have from him, but you say that the tongue can be a rudder, the tongue can be a tree, the tongue can be fire. Was it weird to write a whole book on the tongue?
Ever so slightly, you know, because at the end of the day, what we're talking about is the faculty of speech, and that draws on more than just a physical organ, because obviously, like, animals have tongues, but animals don't necessarily have speech in the dignified way that we have speech. So, yeah, I think that the tongue, it's something that appeals very readily to people's imaginations. The cover of the book is meant to kind of tap into that. But it's meant really to bring with it, or to appeal by synecdoche, to the whole faculty of speech and all that goes into that by way of thought, by way of affection, by way of habit, you know, by way of training. And so, yeah, I think it's just a really fun way to focalize our understanding of the moral life and our practice of the moral life, because our thoughts typically come out in words and eventually issue in deeds. So it's a nice little nexus point for thinking about how the Lord is at work.
So you write in the book, if we are to train our tongues, we'll have to grow in virtues, virtues like truthfulness, friendliness, generosity, forthrightness. Why is training our tongues so vital for living a virtuous life? And can you talk also about the metaphor of a garden for training our tongue and rooting out bad habits?
Sure. Yeah, I think about it in the sense that our tongue gives expression to our thoughts and affections, and our tongue also gives shape to our thoughts and affections. So there's a kind of downtake and uptake. Maybe like vocal prayer is a great way in which to gain insight to this. So, like, why do we use our voices to pray when we could just think and love in God's direction? Well, there's a sense in which our vocal prayer gives issue, or it kind of like gives expression to our interior devotion. And then it also has a way of exciting our interior devotion, which is to say, like, sometimes when you're really thinking about the Lord, loving towards the Lord, you might find yourself just moved to say out loud, like, Lord, you are worthy, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But also, if you're feeling ever so slightly off or punky, and you realize, you know, my mood doesn't matter too terribly much because Jesus is still Lord and his church is still a privileged place of encounter, you might just say something as a way by which to kind of rectify your interior dispositions, like, Lord, you are worthy. And so there's a kind of downtake and uptake by way of the tongue. And so I think when it comes to the virtuous life, there's a sense in which we in being conscious of how our tongue is steering the ship, we can be more attentive to both how it's giving expression to our interior life and then how it's forming our interior life. And the image that I propose that you point out is that of a garden. So, you know, say that you are entrusted with the care of a garden. If you set for your object the elimination of all weeds, then even if you're really successful, at the end of the day, all you would have would be an empty garden. Whereas if you set for your object the cultivation of good growth, which is to say the planting and maintaining of beautiful things, then sure, weeds might still crop up, but typically they're easier to identify in the sense that they've been pushed to the periphery of the garden. They're just not as troubling because it's set within an overall view of life or an overall kind of life project, which is more generally edifying or upbuilding.
And that's really a Thomistic idea, like that, you know, evil is the absence of good versus being so fixated on your faults that you sort of lose the sense of God's love and mercy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think too, you know, it's good to make a little examination of conscience, definitely before you go to the sacrament of confession, but a lot of times folks will do it before they go to bed, you know, this idea of a daily examine. But at various points in our lives, we might be more or less well-disposed to that examine, because sometimes it can just become an occasion of auto-accusation. It just becomes a mental list of the various ways in which we failed as we enter into an extended exercise of, yeah, like recrimination, really, which is awful. And so I think the idea here isn't so much like, let's not talk about unpleasant things, because sometimes you need to talk about unpleasant things. But I think the idea is, let's go where God is dispensing life. Let's go where there's grace, where there's virtue, where there's gifts of the Holy Spirit, where there is something rather than the absence of something. And then we'll be able to deal with the sins, the vices in due course. But we can't make that our object because there's no there.
And how much of this idea to write the book came out of your experience in confession and how people talked about their sins or how you wanted to help them overcome the things that they said over and over again, especially related to sins of the tongue?
Some.
Yeah.
As is the case with most things in life, some.
Some.
Yeah, and I think that when it comes to the sacrament of confession, obviously there are certain things into which we as a culture fall with greater frequency. And then there are certain things which we as a culture might just forget. You know, we might just lose sight of, we might just not be conscious of as sinful. And so there are certain folks who are conscious of, like, gossip, for instance, detraction, slander as sins. But there are a lot of folks who aren't. It's actually not, it doesn't come up a ton, or it doesn't come up as much as it might. I suspect that that's a better formulation. So I think that part of the point of the book, too, is not so much to, like, afflict the conscience as to illumine the conscience. Because I think that, like, God sheds a light on those parts of our lives which he intends to clean up. To a certain extent, they kind of lie veiled in obscurity. And then when he shines the light through the workings of conscience, we come to an appreciation of, woof, yeah, that's not good. But also, praise be Jesus Christ, because he has a plan for healing and growing, you know, a plan for maturing us beyond those things. So he gives us what we need, and he gives us, you know, what we need in the time that he intends to kind of work it to its conclusion, you know, or unfold it in its development.
I really love the chapter on lying. I loved every chapter in this book. But you point out that much of our bad talk, gossip, lying, disparagement, or withdrawing from conversation stems from a rejection of communion. And that word communion and justice, those two, you put them against each other or with each other a lot in the book. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of the sins against justice that lying and gossip are?
Yeah, I think so. Like, the introduction to the book is about communion. Specifically, like, that's the point of the faculty of speech, is it's supposed to facilitate the coming together of persons.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about our human lives, right, we're in spirited bodies or embodied spirits. And so if we're going to share our spiritual lives, we need to concretize them through the working of our bodily lives so that other persons can kind of take that up in their bodily lives and then subsequently abstract into their spiritual lives. But the real promise is that we can come together and that we can do so by a kind of confluence of thought and affection. So we should be making efforts to commune, which is to say, to share what we actually think, to impart what we actually love, and to come to an appreciation of how the other individual is capable of receiving that, reciprocating that, and the kind of claim that that places on us. So then, like, the first chapter is about telling the truth, because you can't commune except in the truth. Like, you can't really share a life in falsity, because again, that's just, it's not a stable foundation. Truth be told, it's not a foundation. And so there has to be an effort on the part of those engaged in this enterprise to really pick out where they're exaggerating, or where they're equivocating, or where they're shying away from difficult truths, or whatever it is, so that we can, yeah, abide in the real. And then on that basis, then I'll go ahead and talk about conversation as a kind of art to cultivate, because it's worth, you know, like virtuous application, because that's just what we do as human beings. That's how we come together, is by the exchange of not just ideas, but of affections, of sentiments, of all that we're able to share. And then the subsequent chapter is about these sins of speech, like insult or detraction or calumny or whispering or derision, you know, but gossip is a word that we use to cover a lot of that territory. And I think, like, part of it is the recognition that we owe each other a certain honor for their excellence, a certain, you know, like, respect for their relationships, a certain, yeah, like, solicitude for their reputations. Like, all of these things are due to other person's injustice, because they're genuine possessions and we ought not defraud them or rob them of that which is theirs. But I try to set it within a more kind of overall conversation, that we have the opportunity within the setting of the mystical body to build up the whole. We have the opportunity to really, like, help people come to an appreciation of how God is blessing them and how that's good news. So instead of living in kind of competitive or comparative modes, we can live in genuinely edifying or upbuilding modes. And I think that's, yeah, that's the promise, which I think is good news.
Well, what I love about the book is that when you bring up these things that could bring us down, lying, cheating, gossip, you offer an antidote, and they're pretty gentle. But I have to say that the Gestapo example, I had to read that over a couple of times, because you point out something that all of us have probably done in our lives. What would I do in a situation where a lie might save a person's life? Can you talk a little bit about, did you use a lot of Thomistic reasoning in how you came to write that part of the book?
Yeah. And I think what I'm trying to do in that part of the book is broaden the conversation, because I think the temptation is to think about one example. It's really difficult. And then to base our whole ethic off that one example. But the problem with that is, you know, like, let's say that you got a person, for instance, who has, like, a deathly allergy to gluten. You know, this person has celiac disease. And if the person were to make an ethic of, you know, clean food consumption on the basis of that one fear that he or she will accidentally ingest gluten, it might look like an ever so slightly strange nutritive recommendation, because it'd be, like, based off a certain anxiety. It'd all be based off a certain fear. Or, like, for instance, you wouldn't ask a dermatologist to, you know, like, judge a beauty contest, because the dermatologist would be, like, focused on blemishes and pockmarks and whatever, like, yada yada, this and such, instead of kind of taking it in. You might ask somebody else for that. So I think that part of the reason why I bring the example up is because so many people think about the example, but I also wanted to use it as a way by which to broaden the conversation. Because at the end of the day, like, the goal in life isn't just to, like, furnish the right answer. The goal in life is to become a good person, right? That's to say, the goal in life is to cultivate those virtues which fill out our character and make us excellent at navigating stressful situations and unstressful situations alike. And so I think that I really wanted to place a certain emphasis on moral creativity. Sometimes we put ourselves in bad situations where it's like, either you lie and save people, or you tell the truth and kill people, you murderous lout. It's like, holy smokes, I don't actually think that's what's at stake. So I just think that we have to take it in kind of within its context. What are the chances that you tell a convincing lie to a trained murderer? You know, very low, unless you've been lying a lot. Like, unless you're a trained liar. But then at that point, you're a trained, do we want to be trained liars, you know? Or, you know, like, if that's the case, then how should we be seeking to prepare? I think, like, the best proximate preparation is, all right, I'm going to pray. All right, I'm going to fast. All right, I'm going to make vigil. Okay, I'm going to ask the Lord such that when the time comes and I'm placed in stressful circumstances, that I respond generously. So, like, for instance, something like this happened in the 4th century, and St. Augustine comments upon it in one of his treatises, Contra Mendacium or De Mendacio. The Bishop of Tagus was sheltering certain individuals from their persecutors, and the persecutors came and knocked and said, do you have, you know, Orthodox Christians in your basement? And he said, I know exactly where they are, and I'm not going to tell you. So he just got out ahead of it. And so then they imprisoned him and tortured him. But apparently, the way the story goes, his patience, his perseverance converted his persecutors. All right, so we just can't anticipate what God is doing. And the fact of the matter is that we ought to be good agents of divine providence rather than like good engineers of outcomes, because we can't engineer the outcomes. We're foolish to think that we can engineer the outcomes. As if to say like, oh, if you tell a lie to this Gestapo officer, that'll definitely take you at your word and then move on. It's like, no, he won't. He's going to come in your house. And so, yeah, I use the example as a way by which to contend with a lot of our moral intuitions, because a lot of people are very convinced as to this issue. But I just, yeah, I'm always nervous when my moral intuitions differ from those of St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, because I know I'm not smarter than them, and I know I'm not holier than them. And so I just don't know what grounds I would have for differing with them, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
Well, you quote a lot of people in this book, both secular and religious, and as you developed this whole theme of communion, I did think of Aristotle's levels of friendship, and the highest one being to will the good of another, which is really what your book is all about in being in communion. And one of the things that really struck out at me was when you talked about a chapter on how to speak about people when they're with you and when they're not with you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I think the basic idea is, you know, we want to cultivate communion whether the persons are present or absent. And if they're absent, I don't think that you necessarily speak about them as if they were present, because that's like ever so slightly strange. But I think that you speak about them with an eye to communion with them. You know, like let's say, for instance, that you have an argument with a close friend and you're trying to troubleshoot your problem with another friend. I think it's healthy to be candid about what hurt and why it hurt, what she said and how that registered, what you intend to do, and whether or not that's a good or bad approach. Like, I think those are all good things to do. But I think that they just need to be undertaken with an eye to communion, because sometimes the temptation is like, listen, I've been hurt by this individual, and so I'm going to hurt him or her back. You know, so it's somebody snubs you in conversation, so you break off into another conversation with a sympathetic individual and say, like, this person over there, you're like, totally silly, right? You know, am I right? Because you're just trying to settle a score in your own mind and heart. Or, I don't know, like maybe we're willing to talk about people because if we traffic in their secrets or if we traffic in their reputations, then we'll gain admission to a certain circle. You know, we'll be admitted in certain company, which we value, which we treasure, which we want to have. And I think it's just good to be conscious of, you know, like to acknowledge those temptations, right? Those dynamics at work in our life, and then just to kind of subject them to the reign of God and say, like, Lord, I want to live in your kingdom. And I just know that there just isn't bad talk in your kingdom. So heal me, grow me, help me, love me, you know? And because I think at a certain level, all of us are afraid that we're going to miss out or that we're going to be like overlooked or otherwise passed up. But in the mystical body, we need not fear.
And I had flagged some quotes that directly relate to what you just said, where you talk about gossip as the delicious sense of secret intimacy, solemn, delicious morsels that go down into the inner parts of the body. And what I really liked was a kind of collusion between the teller and the listener. So two people become closer by trashing somebody else, basically, and how twisted that is.
Yeah. Sad. Yeah, no, but it makes sense on account of the fact that, like, if we feel like we don't have access to genuine communion, we'll settle for non-genuine communion. Mm-hmm. Like, if we don't feel like we have access to upbuilding relationships, then we'll settle for any relationships.
And another big part of the book is on fraternal correction. And you give some really practical advice about how to figure out when to say something and when not to say something. Tell us about those three steps in discerning whether you should open your mouth.
Yeah. So the first one is just, you know, does this thing matter? Sometimes we're on about whatever it is, and we might not need to be on about whatever it is, because it's just not that big of a deal. You know, so like you're in a workplace environment, and one of your colleagues might be, you know, like she might not use her time as well as she could use her time. But you're also conscious of the fact that she's going through things and she's working her way back into a normal rhythm. And if you were to come down hard on her, this is like somebody who's of the same rank as you, then it might actually complicate your relationship and deprive her of one of the resources on which she can rely in the workplace setting to cope, to manage, to struggle, to strive. So you might say to yourself, like, I'm going to put a pin in this, and then I'm going to come back to it and see if it's getting better or if it's getting worse. Like, I think part of it is just to leave people space to address a thing. Or it might just be that the thing isn't actually that important at all. Mm-hmm. You know, the person's got post-nasal drip, and you say to yourself, this person needs to know that this is the most annoying thing in the world. Maybe they don't. Maybe you just need to work your own way through it. And then the next thing is, can this person change? Which is a related consideration. So you have to take into account the subjective disposition of the individual whom you address, because it's not just like a correction handed down in the abstract. It's a correction applied in the concrete to this individual. How is he or she doing? How is this time better or worse than other times? That type of consideration. And then the last one is, do I love? Because the thing that will commend the correction, specifically among equals or between equals, is love, you know, because it has to be the type of thing where it's, I'm motivated to help you address this obstacle to conversion or just to the good life in general. So I think that that spares us a lot of unnecessary correction, potentially hurtful correction, because people are sensitive. We're all sensitive, and we don't want to just cause damage unscrupulously or unthinkingly.
So because you live in community, you give some examples of some of the traps that you have fallen into related to these various chapter titles. But in terms of living together, eating together, the art of conversation, it's something I love. I've published cookbooks and try to, you know, manage who should sit next to each other at a dinner table. How do you sort of try to craft that in your own life of, I think this new guy should sit next to this guy, and then maybe I'll bring up a really funny story that I want him to tell. Do you consciously do that kind of thing?
The thing that I think works best, or for lack of a better explanation, you know, leads best to the flourishing of those present, is asking good questions, which are open-ended and like low pressure, but mm-hmm. also afford people the opportunity to share with some measure of vulnerability. So I don't typically ask, like, what's your favorite movie? Because that's kind of a pressure-filled question, because mm-hmm. you feel like you have to pick the best one and then share the best one in a way that other people recognize and respect. Whereas you can say, like, what's a religious movie that you've seen in the past 3 years that didn't stink? You know, you've kind of set them up in a way where they can mention this or that or the other thing, and it affords a jumping off point, like, well, why? You know, like, why didn't it stink? Or, like, what about the representation of the Lord did you appreciate in this thing by comparison to that thing? But it's like, you know, it's pertinent to the stuff of life. It's pertinent to, like, what we want to be talking about. And it affords people a kind of scope in which they can share their insights and have those insights received. So I think that, like, I think it's so important in conversation to ask good questions and then to listen, because I think that listening can be so nourishing. Because a lot of people are just used to not being listened to. They're just used to having folks with their phones in their hands and their head in the clouds, planning the next thing that they themselves will say just as soon as you stop talking, you know? So I think that, listening can be such a precious gift that one gives to an interlocutor or to a dialogist. So I think that, like, trying to generate those types of situations or create the conditions for those types of situations is what I kind of have in mind.
Well, one of the lighter parts of the book is how important laughter is and humor is in all of this. What inspired you to put that into the book?
I don't actually remember, to be honest. I've forgotten so many things in recent history that it's upsetting. But alas, it seems like this is the general trajectory of my life. But I think what I wanted to highlight is that it's not just a matter of mastering those virtues about which Christians think readily, you know, faith, hope, charity, temperance, chastity, whatever. It's about becoming a full human being. And part of becoming a full human being is helping other people to become full human beings and making conversation delightful and drawing others in and helping them to address the difficulties of life with some measure of pleasure or joy. And I think that humor really does that in spades.
So in these last days of Lent, if we're kind of trying to do a reset when it comes to the sins of speech, explain how in this last chapter you bring it all together, that prayer has to end up being the foundation of all of this.
Yeah, I think of this line from one of these C.S. Lewis novels that no one reads called Till We Have Faces. He says, you can't come face to face with God until you have a face, until we have faces. And so there's a sense in which God's grace interfaces with us as human beings. It's not just something that makes us holy otherwise, but it's the type of thing that heals us as human beings, it's the type of thing that grows us as human beings. And so we need to have a deep appreciation for our humanity if we intend to live the divine life which God bestows with such generosity. And so I think that every effort that we make in kind of purifying or refining or, investing in our conversation is going to reverberate through the life of prayer. Like as we learn to talk to each other, we're learning to talk to God. And as we learn to talk to God, we're learning to talk to each other. So I just wanted to treat that in a last chapter to kind of help bring before people's minds and hearts, like the spiritual applicability or the spiritual import of all the things that went before. So, coming together in speech, telling the truth, hosting conversation, building each other up, correcting in charity, injecting some humor, preaching and teaching with some measure of competence. Like it's all pertinent. It's all pertinent.
Well, I highly recommend this book. It has really opened my eyes to a lot of things I say or should say or never should have said. And so, Father Pine, thank you so much for joining us to learn more about you. Where can we go?
Yeah, great question. I think folks can just Google me. But the book's available through stpaulcenter.com/trainingthetongue. And then folks can follow up with, I contribute to a podcast called Godsplaining, which is where I do a lot of digital stuff at this stage of the game.
Thanks for joining us, Father.
My joy. Thanks for having me.
Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire, and it's so fun to have the team together today as we launch the beginning of Lent. And I know that we were going to talk today about Senator Ben Sasse, who I think has really helped us with his witness as he is dying with stage 4 pancreatic cancer to reflect in a particular way on life and suffering. In the beginning of Lent. And I wanted to read a quote of his that he said recently that I found very profound. He said, "Death and dying aren't the same. The process of dying is still something to be lived." And I really think he's exemplifying that in the way that he's giving a very beautiful and profound Christian witness in his death. And it particularly resonates after having just read some of the really frightening data coming out of Canada about medical aid in dying and how more and more people are opting to just take their lives instead of living out and enduring that suffering at the very end. So that's just a takeaway that I've had from his witness. I don't know, what's struck all of you about his witness in these moments of suffering?
What I found especially compelling is just going off what you just said, Ashley, was the way his demeanor in the Hoover Institute interview. He's so down to earth, even down to the way he's dressing, the way he sort of, I mean, just says it as an aside. Oh, sorry, this is a wave of nausea. Like, oh, you'll need to understand if I'm sitting in a funny way because of the tumors on my spine. And while he draws from obviously deep, rich, like theological, biblical traditions about death and dying and mortality and everything, the way he talks about it is just so familiar that I think he exemplifies what he's talking about in terms of like being present in the now and not skipping ahead to the end or not acknowledging that he is dying, but that dying is something to be lived, like you said. It's remarkable, I think, the way he's able to carry himself right now and talk about that, and at the same time have a podcast on Monty Python. I just think it's such an incredibly beautiful witness, especially people who are in middle age, because I think we all think that, death is what happens to old people, and not people with young children. And so he's bringing all of that and all that sort of fleshy reality like to the fore. And I think it's a real gift.
It was very reminiscent for me of the death of the late Cardinal Joseph Bernardin in Chicago, who died of pancreatic cancer as well, who was in his mid-60s when he did so. And his oncologist was a Dominican nun at Loyola's medical center. And I remember when he said the week that she came and she said to him, "You're going to die this week." And he wrote down a lot of notes, a beautiful book that became The Gift of Peace. And one of the very last things he did with his time on earth to redeem the time, which is something that Ben Sasse went back to multiple instances during his reflection there, was that he wrote to the Supreme Court about assisted suicide and said, "As someone who is so vulnerable now, I am begging you, do not do anything that would make assisted suicide or medical aid in dying or whatever you want to call it, that would make that available to people who are vulnerable, because you're never more vulnerable than when you're looking at the very end." And so just there's so much profundity in that interview, but also it's because it's through a lens of faith that I think that we find it so resonating. And you know, it reminds me of something my mother used to say: "I don't know what people without faith do."
Right. Well, last week I had the privilege of interviewing Dr. Lydia Dugdale, who has been a really outspoken medical ethicist and is herself a physician, about the assisted suicide bill, what they call it, medical aid in dying, the euphemism that just passed in New York. And so her book, The Art of Dying, is about the Ars Moriendi, which was really written by the Catholic Church and one of the councils in response to the bubonic plague, where people were in front of their family and death was everywhere. And so Ben Sasse said this quote in that same Hoover Institute interview that I thought was really applicable to what Lydia said. "Death is a wicked gift. I don't want it to happen, but we're mortals, and it seems like it's not sophisticated or modern or naive to pretend we're not mortals. It's true. And so you got to grapple with big questions. And this is not news to me that I had numbered days. It just became a more precise number. We all have numbered days. So, you know, what do you do with that?" And here he is, you know, getting on a podcast and laying it all bare for all of us to think about in our own lives.
I was thinking too how, again, going back to Lent, Lent is like a mini death. It's like a period where we die to some of our vices, and you feel the coming of the death of Jesus. And it's been interesting to see the way that Ben Sasse has used this time of actual death to reflect on things he wished he would have done, or habits or vices that he wished he would have let go of earlier. And one of the things that really caught my attention, because it was on a Sunday and I was driving from one baseball practice to another baseball practice and then rushing home and taking a kid to play practice, was his comments on the Sabbath. And he said, "If I had to do it over again, I would think a lot more intentionally about how to be more ambitious in my household and take the Lord's Day and the Sabbath more seriously than all the ways I was a workaholic for decades." And, you know, I think all of us can understand the struggle of trying to protect the Sabbath. And my husband literally just texted me the quote as I'm like driving from here to there to there. And so that, you know, I think he's, because death is so imminent for him, he's giving us lessons right now. He's telling us, giving us wisdom that it's worth reflecting on. That somebody who's running out of time is saying, "These are the things I wish I would have done better." And even though we're already, you know, well into Lent, several days into Lent, it's not too late to step back and say, "What are some of the ways that I can incorporate these wisdoms from somebody who's literally wishing that he could take back certain aspects of his life?" So I don't know if any of you had noticed other things that he had said in that vein about things he wished he would have done differently or better, or if that had caused any of you to reflect similarly.
Well, actually, I felt very convicted about what he said about just being a father and being present in his home and being a guide and a resource and a role model, most importantly for his children, as well as his wife. And just as a mom, I felt very, you know, challenged by that. Like, when have I put, things that at the end of the day really weren't that important in front of time with my children, or something my child needed, and I thought something else I wanted to do was better. There is just something that everyone can take from this particular interview, and I've listened to it 2.5 times now. I feel like I pull away something new from it every time, because first of all, he was just laid bare everything, his soul, his heart, his mind. But then the interviewer himself, I think there was a lot of prayer that went into that interview before either of them started it, because this is something, you mark my words, people are going to be writing about and commenting on long after Ben Sasse is gone to be with the Lord.
One of the things that I thought was really curious was that he said that he probably should have been a football coach. He sort of starts the interview that way. And I was thinking, okay, because as I'm watching you, I'm thinking, what a loss for the Senate and for political leadership in the United States, because I love his ideas about educational reform. But I wished he had talked more about why he thinks he would have been better off just being a football coach.
His dad was at University of
Yeah, he
Nebraska.
mentioned that.
And of course, he's from Nebraska, where football is just like
Right.
it's there's a lot that, they don't have any professional sports teams, so the Nebraska football team is the thing. But he had such a brilliant head. I should not speaking of him in the past tense. He has his PhD in history at Yale from Yale because he loved to read books, and he said, "I wanted to go somewhere where I would have to read 100 books a month." And he talks at great length, or about how America doesn't read anymore, and I felt convicted by that as well, because I used to be a voracious reader. And he said, "Now we're all just scrolling through Instagram looking for 2-minute clips to watch, and that's substituting for what used to be reading time." I'm like, "Oh, you don't say." Because everybody, I think, used to have kind of a standard time when they read, whether it was before you went to bed or at lunchtime. I always carried a book with me on my lunch hour, and I hadn't really thought about it in that way, that those days are kind of gone now. And we need to find a new way to broaden people's, intellectual life, but also their spiritual life. And you often do that by reading.
Yeah, and I think that too, I often find my, I mean, I know Betsy does too. We both like the long form essays, but when you read them on your phone, you have all the other distractions of your phone there. So
Right.
even when I see, I'll save an article and be like, this is when I'm going to do it. I've got my tea or my coffee. This, I'm sitting in my special reading chair. I'm going to read this article on my phone, 25-minute read. And I'm interrupted the entire time. I mean, there's just no substitute for, I mean, I guess a Kindle without Wi-Fi isn't as a good substitute, but just holding a book in your hand and having that thing, having that just dedicated reading time. And I think that that goes back to what he was saying about the Sabbath. It's so easy, especially when you have jobs, and which so many of us do these days, after, especially after the pandemic, where we work from home and there's no separation of between like work hours and home hours, because you're just home all the time. And then the weekend and weekdays kind of flow into each other too. And even during Lent, as Catholics, we're fasting, we're abstaining from meat on Fridays. It's easy to just sort of, just quickly remember, oh, I need to eat, I need to not eat meat today, and then sort of move on without there being any sort of reflection or just even something that's just marked for yourself or a family. And I think that I'm glad that Ben Sasse is here talking to us about this, because it would hate it for us for it to happen for all of us to only have sort of this sort of date in mind where it's all going to be over, that makes us realize that it's all running together and we're not making time to read books and we're not doing these things, and the distraction is sort of like the main game
I have
of
a
our
friend
days.
who's a retired lawyer who teaches CCD at her parish, and she is charged with the confirmation class for the 8th graders. And there was some kind of like parental petition to, it's normally after the family mass on Sunday mornings, and there's some kind of parental petition now to move the class to Wednesday afternoons because they have sports on Sunday mornings. And it used to be in the Catholic League, you did nothing before noon on Sunday. There could be a game Sunday afternoon, but nothing before noon on Sunday. And now the parents won't even come to, and some parishes caved and said, okay, we'll do it on Wednesday, thinking, we'll appease them in order, so we don't lose them completely. But sports has taken over Sundays. And this is where I think the church can learn so much from the Orthodox Jewish community, for which the Sabbath is sacrosanct, and there is so much, Even Jews who have left their faith still will observe the Sabbath in many cases because of the way it gave them rest, but also that time with their family. I mean, my youngest is going off to college next year, and God willing, I just think, where did the time go? And everybody tells you that when you're a young mom, and Ashley, keep this in mind, and Lee, but you don't believe them because you're so tired all the time. And then you turn around and your last one's going to college. And Betsy, you're nodding your head. I think you know what I mean.
I do. I wanted to just make a shout out since we're talking about Sabbath. Abraham Heschel, the great rabbi, has an amazing book called Sabbath. And also Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture. Those are two books that I have in my library that I really love. And I also just think that there's a lot of stuff I try not to do on Sundays because if I don't stop, then I feel exactly what Lee said. All my days run together, shopping or cleaning, or I just try to, especially on Sunday mornings, to just really slow down, gear down. Sometimes we'll have several couples we get together for brunch, or I just light a fire and pick a good book and sit by the fire.
Lee, you share a connection to Ben Sasse in that you both have degrees. He has a master's, but your undergraduate degree was from St. John's College, the Great Book School, which is a very unique program that does its own thing and follows its own course. Everybody reads the same great texts together. Do you see kind of imprints of that education in the way Ben Sasse talks about civilization, civic-mindedness, culture, reading? Do you see some familiar threads?
Yeah, it's funny because he was in the Graduate Institute, but he and I actually graduated the same year, so we overlapped. But I, of course, he wasn't Ben Sasse then. But yeah, of course, I mean, I do definitely. And in fact, I kept wondering. I mean, I kept expecting him to say something because I felt like his interlocutor, Peter, asked him so many great questions, and when he was answering them, I kept thinking he was going to refer back to his time at St. John's because, I mean, either, I don't know, chicken or egg, it was on my mind, or it reminded me of my time at St. John's College with the great books. But also his talk in general and what we're talking about right now is making me think my husband's actually on a panel this coming weekend at the Santa Fe campus for the inauguration of the new Santa Fe president. And I'm going to go and listen to him. And then I thought, oh, that's going to be a long time to listen, even to my husband. And I suppose I can't really sneak and look at my phone because what if there are other Johnnies in the audience? And what if, I don't know what their culture is there now, but I can't imagine a world in which cell phones and apps and all that kind of thing fit into that when everyone, all you had to do for class was to bring your text and your notebook, no laptops, no anything like that. So that's really, I mean, of course, I thought more about myself than, I think the whole different, implications for society as a whole from reading books. But it did make me think about those days when the only thing that you needed were books and maybe a pencil.
And I believe he's also, he has spoken about tech. It's interesting because I think he's using technology really well. I mean, he made the announcement of his death on Twitter. In a long post, but it's like everything he's doing is very redemptive. And I just think whether it's about technology or about personal relationships or the way he's speaking, I mean, he could use these moments. We talked about his interview with the Hoover Institution, and he touches on politics, but he doesn't use it for ad hominem attacks or to, fire final shots. Or, to take down narcissistic personalities that probably should be taken down. Instead, he uses it to reflect on what is the role of the politician and how can we help redeem American politics. And again, I've got to believe that his faith is what is grounding him in that way and giving him such a redemptive death. Because, we've discussed together other examples, recent examples of people who've been forced to face their own mortality and how it's not necessarily marked by the same peace that he seems to have. And You mentioned Lee, just his demeanor, like he seems at peace, he's smiling. You would never know he was about to die, honestly.
What did you ladies think about his reference to the raising of Lazarus by Jesus and of Martha running out and saying, Lord, if you had been here, he would not have died? And he talks about that as her narcissistic moment, which I've never heard in any analysis of that scripture passage before. I always thought it showed her great faith in the Lord. Like, if you had been here, this wouldn't have happened because, you know, you could have healed him. But he said she immediately goes to her own comfort. So, well, you know, the most beautiful way to end this is how he talked about death is the final evil. It's the last thing you have to overcome. You go all through your life struggling and working and trying to overcome bad things that happen to your life. But death is the last one. And then you're done. And then you're with the Lord. And you don't need to worry about that anymore. It's your last big battle. And I love how he phrased that. It's not being Pollyannish about death and the pain and suffering he's having, but it has such hope in Christ and in the promises of a life that we're really being prepared to lead.
Well, that's a perfect note for us to end on. To watch the full interview of Ben Sasse on the podcast Uncommon Knowledge, visit hoover.org for more information. I think we can all say that we commend it to our listeners as great Lent listening to help us to deeper reflect on the themes of this Lent. So thank you, ladies. It was wonderful discussing this with you today.
Thank you, Ashley. Goodbye, ladies. Good to see you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by our chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. Monsignor, we are heading into Holy Week. How can we best prepare for our Lord's resurrection?
Thanks so much for the question, Betsy. Holy Week is holy for two reasons. First, because of everything Jesus did during the first Holy Week. But then second, is because it's supposed to make us holy. If there's one week of the year that we as Catholics need to take with particular seriousness, it's Holy Week. We've been preparing all Lent for it, but now it's game time. And like, are we going to show up ready to play, to use a sports analogy? You know, when I was a pastor, one of the things that would depress me the most would be on Palm Sunday, when I would be greeting people leaving Mass, and they'd say things like, "See you next Sunday, Father." Now, for some, that was just a good habit. And of course, they were coming to Mass every Sunday, which was a good practice. But what it was also indicating was that they weren't planning to come at all to any of the events during Holy Week. And these are special gifts to us. And so I just urge all of our listeners to think about how intentionally they're going to be about Holy Week. When we think about Holy Week, we first think about the sacred Triduum. We've never received a more important dinner invitation than the Lord's own for Holy Thursday, when he says, "I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you." It's the greatest meal of all time, which nourishes really our soul better than anything else. And I hope that Catholics will prioritize it over watching the Sweet 16 as part of March Madness in the NCAA tourney, regardless of what time that Mass is. For us to be able to RSVP and accept the Lord's invitation to come to Holy Thursday to receive him as our great meal, what a wise decision that is. Then for us to pray with him after the Mass. We've got these altars of repose in various churches or in certain cities. People can visit him in seven different altars. We call it the seven church walk. I've loved to lead that both in Boston as well as here in New York City, and did it many times in Rome. So Holy Thursday, super important. Good Friday. If there's one day Catholics should take off from work over the course of the year and use a personal day, it would be Good Friday. We would obviously do it if somebody we really loved was dying that day. We would want to be with them at their bedside. Mom, dad, son, daughter, brother, sister, husband, wife. We would definitely prioritize them. And we should treat the Lord no less than we'd treat any beloved family member. And so for us to show up in some places like New York, There were the seven last words from noon to three. I had the honor to be able to preach last year the seven last words at St. Patrick's in New York City, but done at most of my priesthood and a lot of other places, big cities at least, there are the seven last words someplace. But the Passion Service of the Lord, normally three or just after three, when we can hear the gospel according to St. John as he enters into Christ's passion. We can venerate the cross. We can be together with everybody else who are Jesus' family members as he was giving his life for us. We know liturgically that we're not just reenacting something from 2,000 years ago, but we're entering live into those living memorials. And so Good Friday is so important. And then Holy Saturday, we've got the Easter Vigil, which is the most important Mass of the year, by far the longest Mass of the year. And I would hope that that wouldn't discourage people from coming, but excite people from coming, because every other Mass basically flows from the Easter Vigil. We've got that whole ceremony of light reminding us of Jesus's triumph over darkness and death. We welcome in new brothers and sisters who have been preparing for baptism. This is the most important day in their Catholic life. And it's important for us to welcome them as their fellow family members. We're able to listen to the most nutritious liturgy of the word throughout the entire year with up to 17 readings, seven Old Testament readings, seven Psalms, the New Testament reading, a special Alleluia with a Psalm three times over for the verses, and then the Gospel. So a 17-course meal. Not even Italians eat that way, but that's what the church gives us. And then we've got the celebration of the Eucharist at the Easter Vigil with all our new brothers and sisters with extraordinary joy as we're able to receive Jesus' risen body and blood. And so that's the sacred triduum, which is the most important part of Holy Week. But we likewise need to prepare for it. And so Palm Sunday allows us to get on that game mentality as we ponder that we could, like the first disciples, go from Hosanna to the Son of David in the first gospel of Palm Sunday to crucify him, crucify him, crucify him, give us Barabbas, that by our sins, that's actually what we've chosen, and that we are capable of going from saying Sanctus, Sanctus, Sanctus at Mass to likewise allowing the Lord to have to die in order to take away our sins. And so we're able to insert ourselves there. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to prepare for the Triduum by the extraordinary readings from Isaiah and his Suffering Servant Psalms. And then likewise from the Gospels that immediately and historically led up to the sacred Triduum. What an extraordinary gift that we have. It's something that we're supposed to live prayerfully and not live like any other week of the year. But rather than saying to our priests on Palm Sunday, see you next Sunday, it would be great if we said, see you tomorrow, and then see you tomorrow. And then see you tomorrow, because the church wants us to follow Jesus up close during those times. And if Mass times, for example, are outside of what we're capable of doing, it is good for us at least to try to get to the church and make a short little visit of prayer. And if we can't even get to the church, to pause more than what we ordinarily do, to just make sure we're entering into the mind of Christ as he's thinking about us, as he's entering into his Paschal mystery.
Thank you for all the encouragement, and I love the way that you use the whole 17-course meal as a draw of why it's so important. Thanks, Monsignor Landry.
God bless you, Betsy. Happy Holy Week.
This is Jim Pinto, Director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN Media Missionaries prayerfully take EWTN to parishes and the community through the print and electronic media we provide. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.